is Australia's number one rock show, Countdown.
It all began with Countdown, that old music show on TV presented by the funky cowboy-hatted Egyptologist named Molly. My older sister, Sujatha, was mesmerised by the scratching and the raw energy of the rapping in Run DMC's Walk This Way that Mr. Meldrum introduced to Aussie audiences in the 80s. Our parents immigrated to Australia from India in 1973. Sujatha is 15 months older than me, and as older siblings tend to do, she broke in my parents as she came of age. It was the 80s. We were surrounded by social ferment and political engagement.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
You see, our parents would have heated discussions with their friends about anarchism and debate whether to move up north and join a commune. In the end, we didn't go. Indians just didn't do that kind of thing. During our school holidays, we were sent to stay with my Auntie Dina in Sydney's West. Auntie Dina worked with women who were being beaten by their husbands. She helped them and us learn that it's never okay for a man to hit a woman. And unlike me, Sujatha was a serious reader. While I was devouring Archie comics, Sujatha was picking up books about feminism and racism in my Auntie Joyce's house. Jermaine Greer's Female Eunuch, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. I also remember her furiously writing letters to my mum's cousin Nigel, a socialist activist who was working with the Pintubi Aboriginal peoples out in the Northern Territory. When my sister and I were teenagers, we watched my dad get retrenched and struggle to find another job. Unemployment was high due to serious economic recession, public sector cutbacks, and the decline of manufacturing industries, all inspired by Thatcher and Reagan-style free market policies. In Maroubra, the working-class beachside neighbourhood where we grew up, youth unemployment led to problems of heroin addiction and crime and violence between rival surf gangs. People gradually withdrew from politics and into their private lives.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
My sister turned to hip-hop to fill the void.
I felt really empowered to be, one, working with people of colour, you and Alec, being Indian, Polynesian, myself being Australian Aboriginal, and working together on songs that we talked a lot.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about stuff all the time, you know, our little political minds were ticking over and we'd discuss all sorts of things.
That's Sujatha's rapping partner, Wayata Talfa. Wayata grew up in a housing commission complex in a semi-rural town called Al Norlunga, on the outskirts of Adelaide, with her mother and three brothers. Her mum came from the Point Pierce mission to the city to work as a domestic. Wayata moved to Sydney in the early 90s, where she and Sujatha met.
So when we came together and we wrote those songs together, I felt like a bit of a force.
To tell you the truth, like I got out there and I was like, yeah, boy, I'm just going to smash these people with this song. You know what?
We're going to tell you this and we're going to get you right in the guts, man. So,
like the Blackfella song.
Yeah, yeah.
Should we sing it?
Yeah. I'll try. Which way to go?
Okay.
Blackfella, Blackfella, whoa. Blackfella, Blackfella, yeah. Blackfella, Blackfella, whoa. You got to stand up for your rights.
Woo.
And what was it? We're not no reconciliation package going to rectify the damage. Assimilation policies covered with candy. Supposed to make life all nice and dandy. How convenient and oh so handy. Black fellas over here, over on the left side. Black fellas over there, over on the right side. Black fellas in the middle saying hey diddle diddle. And crats sitting on the fence playing with their fiddles. Time to wipe the bullshit from our eyes. Every time we die, we're living their lives. There were people in the country supposed to be free. Every Every time they make the dollars off our backs, we bleed. Yeah, I said, black fella, why is it so that we die so young and into prison we go? Black fella, why can't you see that the future of our children is up to you and me? Black fella, whoa. Black fella, yeah. Black fella, whoa. You got to stand up for your rights.
I remember that. It.
It's been a long time since Sujatha and Wayada rapped together. My sister is now a professor in New York City. She's married and has two small children. During a recent trip to Australia, Suji and Wayada got together and they reminisced.
We couldn't really figure out a name, could we, for a group?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
We called ourselves the Witches of Hip Hop.
Yeah.
But it's funny how that was the first connection that we had, was that I had seen that billboard and it really struck me. I was like, I didn't know it was an anti-racism ad. I just remember seeing They Say I'm Too Pretty to Be an Aboriginal, and I was like, wow, that's a really strange message to be putting across on a billboard.
Yeah, yeah.
And that you had also, you know, you were in the billboard and we happened to meet. And I think that was this kind of chord that struck with both of us, that we then, you know, began talking about that. And then when we started talking about hip hop, I still remember you told me that one of the first songs you'd heard was The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
How that
song impacted you. And I just remember also hearing that song, maybe it was on Rage or something, you know, and listening to that song and just how, for me, it had such an impact. And I think that was the second thing we kind of clicked on.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yeah, that was, I guess, my first introduction to hip-hop, what became knowledge of hip-hop culture. And I guess just in the message that really struck me was that these men, these black men, were out on the street, and we were out on the street. We were also, I guess, experiencing a lot of the stuff that was in the message, not in the same context, but similarities, you know, about being disenfranchised, dispossessed, and all of those things, and I guess not really having a lot of hope, but trying to be politically active in the message that we're trying to get across, I suppose. And it just stayed with me for a long time, and I loved hip-hop after that.
Crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage bales, used to be a fag hag, such a dance to tango, skip the life and tango, a certain prince to seem to lost her senses, down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so did it, she had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close.
Back then, Sujatha was busy learning to be an MC. We had no idea that this thing called hip-hop would end up propelling her around the world in search of other young people for whom hip-hop had been life-changing. Nope. Back in 1995, all we knew was that Sujatha and Wayada spent every weekend traipsing out to Sydney's western suburbs to practice and perform.
Central, Redfern, Burwood, Stratfield, Lincoln, Auburn, Glyde, Granville.
And when they formed their twosome, the hip-hop scene in Sydney was pretty diverse. The hubs were suburbs like Bankstown and Casula, home to many new immigrants and Aboriginal families that were pushed out of the inner city by rising rent prices. Brother Black and Monkey Muck were a big part of the scene back then. They formed the popular group called Southwest Syndicate.
Battling with the cynics and what they say. Knuckles trying to get the guy on the muck and spray. Pushing through it all, even if I was a stack. But I hold my act together to keep the bridge packed. We turn this jam out in the city of Sydney. Sydney is my city, it's a great big part of me. I'm feeling free, you'll never be able to stop me. I'll keep going on with this fix for an eternity. Everybody out there, check the single. Hear the jingle, now just move as the beat gets bigger. I hope you heard the word on the curb. That's what
we're not doing it because, you know, we're trying to fit into a circle of people or anything, man. This is our life and this is what we do, man. You know what I mean? And we talk about real shit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That there's no faking the funk with what we've done as Southwest Syndicate and still today with Brother Black and Monkey Mark. Yeah, you know what I mean? Doing what we both do, you know?
Yeah.
There's no faking the funk, man. I mean, that's the thing that sets me aside, sets Mark aside from every other hip-hop artist in Australia is that we rap for our life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That people are just rapping for a scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? We're rapping for causes and for people's lives and our own life. You know?
Been on the mic since I was 12, going back to my roots. Where do I begin? Mixing tracks at the back or relax with the monk. Beats on the one, he bought the funk. A young fella rapping up the storm. A few years gone, Brother Black is born. Taking our message to my peeps, coast to coast. Planting seeds in a hive of activity. We proceed, no matter who it be, to the streets, spreading hip-hop any time of the week.
High up, oh, to lift high, oh, to lift right up, oh, to lift you right, oh.
Scratching my head, don't know where things end. If it has to end, then why does it begin? So I keep to myself and I do what I do. Going back to my roots, it keeps me staying true. Scratching my head, don't know where things end.
Now, whatever you might think of hip-hop music, with its spoken rhymes recited over a drum beat, it certainly seems to have spawned a renewed interest in storytelling and poetry writing among many teenagers. Because of the focus on the spoken word, hip-hop culture has become a voice for young people to express their views on identity, race, community, unemployment and sexuality. Precisely for that reason, a community project initiated by Death Defying Theatre has tried to tap into this well of expression. They've called it Hip Hopera, and they've set up workshops to direct all this talent into a huge multimedia event. Life Matters' Roy Huberman spent time with teenagers in one of these workshops and heard about the experiences behind this explosion of street poetry.
My name is Baba, and I'm
from Baba,
from New York City. Yes, but my mother is from here, so I'm from both places.
It was 1995. Siddhartha had just turned 21. The guys from Southwest Syndicate were attending these hip-hopera workshops, and so too were she and Wayada. There were so many stereotypes about hip-hop back then. The reporter asked them about hip-hop being about gangs and violence. My sister spoke up.
What do you think?
I think that certain elements of it do, but I think that there's, like, hip-hop's not one thing. You can't say hip-hop is much or hip-hop is this, because it's like a dialogue. There's heaps of different, you know, strands of it and stuff, and I think there are strands of it that are and strands of it that aren't. But also on the violent stuff, it just made me think of there's this song, this KRS song, which says that people are always blaming hip-hop and saying hip-hop's violent, you know, it's this, there's guns, blah, blah, blah. But what he says is that America was violent before hip-hop, you know, and so it's society that's violent, it's not hip-hop. Maybe that reflects it in some ways, in gangster rap and some other kinds of rap, but it's not. The music's always getting blamed for it and giving it a bad image, which shouldn't happen.
Ah, what wonderful youthful righteousness. Siddhartha may have only been 21, but what she said back then seems even more true today, with rap music still being blamed for causing society's ills. As Siddhartha went on to discover on her hip-hop travels, regardless of country, rap was a way for people on the margins to tell their stories. Monkey Muck and Brother Black of Southwest Syndicate had their own take on violence and the music.
You do some?
Gangster rap. Oh, gangster rap. He goes gangster rap, Black. He calls it gangster rap, mate. A bit faster. Bit more. Yeah, that's it.
South. My nation of residents is getting hesitant. They can't do shit cause they got no evidence. 200 years of this bullshit. Us Kuris have had enough, so you better quit. Got brothers like me behind bars and in the gutters, betraying us as stupid motherfuckers. The white man's plan is getting out of hand. We're being hung up in your cells all across the land. Keep an eye on them drunks in the park. Time for us to raise up out of the dock. From Broome all the way back to Red Firm, brothers and sisters, stand up, it's your turn.
Crime.
What?
Like you say crime and that, then they're gonna start like giving us a bad name, like the America. All little kids, they love it because it's gangster's paradise. They think, oh, America, menace to society, oh, bang, 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 let's go do a carjack, something like that. But when it comes to music terms like that, it's not like that with Australians, you know what I mean? It's like trying to like say it back in their way, but not with so much violence and stuff like that, you know.
So to you, hip hop is a positive experience.
Yeah. Positive, yeah.
Yeah, because if not, all the people in our group would be in jail, mate. Straight away. A lot of them, mate. If they went into hip hop, they'll be like that. It's something positive, mate. It brings them out of that, from below the gutter to above the gutter, mate.
True. This is the way of like partying, mate, for teenagers, you know, instead of like causing like violence and stuff like that. Like, we've got a way to, like, this is a way we can get everyone partying instead of going out like and breaking the law and stuff like that, you know.
up.
People draw death, we scarce destroy, wreck then left form. Three hits, people's trying to catch breath. Little you deep breath and think about stepping to the crew. When years of experience shows through all my tender state, you. It's like the rank of you're the Gamorrean god in my hand. We never have no band, but the highest DJs in the island.
Some DJs spin out, transform, shape, cross, fade off. Toss and turn soft, turns me off. A straining lead, cruising years, length is strength. A Samson versus beat mixes, cut his ears in half time. So get off the field, you're not needle. Your grooves are feeble.
So, as it turns out, Hip Hopera was a kind of big moment for all the aspiring young MCs in Sydney in the mid-90s. But Wayata and Sujatha definitely stood out.
What the hell am I doing here?
First of all, we're female. Second of all, we're old for this. We're not 14 years old. And yeah. We're just like, maybe hip-hop culture's not for us. Maybe we got to find something else, some other way to express ourselves.
Yeah, but it's like, we had a lot of fun doing it, though.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably one of the biggest crowds I've ever done anything to. It was awesome.
And it's funny when I think about it, because I did this song on nuclear testing, and you wrote a song about the Brady Bunch and your own experiences. And it's funny because I didn't think about it then, but when I look back on it now, it's really interesting how my song was so, you know, third person rapping about a political issue, which was kind of where I was coming from politically, because I'd always been involved in political movements and campaigning and hadn't necessarily thought about it in relation to me myself. And yours was political but very personal.
Yeah.
And when I look back on that now, it's interesting to me how, you know, we had those kind of different takes. I kind of feel like the first rap I wrote was like a master's thesis, because you know, I didn't know how to write in that form. I just was used to writing these kind of political, you could say, diatribes.
Someplace, self-help, no way your brother to rest. A people, the misery and fighting, thunderbolts and lightning. Release our pain, cause we try, cry again, to lose another hung by the prejudice rope. And we hope, because we want this fight. Because we want this fight.
Sujatha moved on from those diatribes. She too began to personalise her rhymes. Being the daughter of Indian immigrants and never ever feeling like she really fit into Australian society was fodder for her next phase of rapping.
Yeah.
Wow.
What's that other one? What's that other one that you used to do too?
Migrants come from overseas. Them that live there, Aborigines. Government making the policy. Want ebony and ivory in harmony.
But we continue to fight for land rights. To protect a sacred site for migrant rights. So we can fly a kite in the middle of the night. No matter if you're black or white. You can hide from the racist tide. You got to stand up and fight.
For the young man a work and he finish a degree, and he want a woman and a family. He say in this country what a child will do, we go to Australia to begin a migrant. But when he come to Australia, the people say, we don't want no Asians coming here to stay. They eat monkey brains and the smell ain't nice. Then people are hot-blooded from eating all that spice. He say to the people, you've gone mad or what? Are these crazy ideas are from where you've got? My skin may be brown, but I'm the same as you. I've the right to live in this land too. We don't take...
Wayata is now a mother of two. She went on to do more writing, performing and recording, but she eventually got disillusioned by the very male, very white world that hip-hop in Australia was becoming. The guys from Southwest Syndicate kept rapping.
It's Brother Black, yes I'm back, and I've got something new just for you and your crew. I'm coming through with deadly beats, fresh attack and a backtrack. Turbo Man on the case and it's all sound and fat.
As many young Aussies do, Sujatha left Australia in the late 90s to travel. However, my sister didn't go to England to work and drink in pubs. She decided to look for other young hip-hoppers around the world and hang out with them. And so began her hip-hop odyssey. Her first stop was Cuba, where I was living at the time. My big sister was coming to visit me. But this traditional and well-known Cuban music was not the music that Suji wanted to check out. She wanted to meet the rappers.
All right, my name is Pablo Herrera Beitia, the Cuban hip-hop producer.
Pablo was one of my close friends. He lived in Santo Suarez, a formerly middle-class area in the south of Havana, now home to working-class blacks. Hip-hop in Cuba owes a lot to Pablo Herrera. Yet where he grew up, and where he was still living at the time Suji met him, was far from a Bronx ghetto or the impoverished western suburbs of Sydney.
My block is kind of old-style 40s, actually 1920s buildings with a mixture of people, you know, reconstructing and refurbishing themselves, their houses, and painting them. Some of the houses aren't really painted, so it's a bit dilapidated, which actually is a bit picturesque. It looks quite nice. It is bright out, blue skies, a little bit breezy, but nice. And you get people outside, and people in tank tops, and people walking down the street, and kids, and old people, and young people, and men and women, and just people, just walking down the street, minding their business, doing their thing, you know.
While I'd never thought to question it, Sujatha was puzzled by the setting in which she found Pablo making his beats. It seemed odd to her that this relative stability was sporting powerful rap music. But in fact, Cuba was in the depths of an economic crisis that was popularly known as the Special Period.
You know, Cubans felt that Cuba was going somewhere by 1982. And when the Soviet bloc fell, the massive crisis that the Special Period became for Cubans trying to make food, trying to make food happen every day for their families was a big thing. And that was this is a crisis that was unprecedented within the revolution, and people just did not know how to handle that. And I think that that's the biggest issue, like the fall of the Soviet Union and the fact that Cuba became lost everything. Cuban hip hop culture existed in Havana before the Special Period, but the Special Period gave it a voice. This is the difference and importance of the Special Period for Cuban hip hop. It was the one time, it's the one thing, one moment in our history that allowed youth to be like, I need to say something about this. Or actually, I can't say something about this because now things and the situation in Cuba is as stark as it actually is in the Bronx. Like, we have nowhere to go, kind of thing.
Tengo una bandera, un escudo, un tocororo, también una palmera y un mapa sin tesoro. Tengo aspiraciones sin tener lo que hace falta. Tengo más o menos la medida exacta. Crónica compacta, polémica que impacta.
Pablo had his own music studio in his apartment. It was a tiny room next to the kitchen. There was a Roland keyboard sampler and, Pablo's proudest piece, an Akai MPC digital sampler that had been sent by Michael Esterson from a US rap label.
Michael called me in my house and said, what you want, what you need to make this record? I said, well, I need an MPC. I had been looking at the MPC in the Source magazine. Talk about influence, right? The Source magazine had this page where there was like a little feature with like all this equipment that you like how to make beats. Like they had those like MPCs, like, oh my god, I need an MPC 2000. So I told him I want an MPC 2000, I want this thing, and I want this thing. And he's like, okay. So when he said he was coming with it and I saw it, I was so excited, I didn't sleep. I would go to bed at 8 o'clock in the morning, wake up at 11, make beats. This is for a whole 10 days. And yeah, I mean, I didn't really know, but I figured it out.
In only 10 days of working with the equipment, Pablo had produced the first ever Cuban hip-hop album. It was called Cuban Hip-Hop All-Stars Volume 1.
Sí, sí. La furia de mi garganta desencadena fuegos artificiales.
¿Cuáles?
Desde que sabe que también merece papeles protagónicos.
Y es lógico.
Quien me escucha ya es parte de un momento histórico.
Único.
Porque tengo propósitos revolucionarios. Bajo mi brazo, un diario.
I left Cuba soon after Sujatha arrived, but she'd caught the Havana hip-hop bug and decided to stay. My sister met Magia and Alexei, the husband-wife duo of the popular Cuban rap group Obsesión. This Obsesión song, Drume Negrita, is about Afro-Cuban independence fighters. Magia and Suji clicked immediately. She, like everyone else in Cuba, called my sister Sui. Magia loved that Sui was also an MC and became Suji's window into the world of what it was like for women rappers in Cuba.
En manos de los hombres, quizás en el caso mío, por ejemplo, ha ayudado un poquito más que somos un grupo mixto.
Well, I guess in my case, it helped that we're a mixed group and that the other person in the group is my husband. But as a woman, there are other sacrifices that I've had to make, like trying to maintain my career inside the hip-hop movement. And it's hard, because if you understand that the movement as a whole lacks resources, for women in the movement, there are even less resources. If you see that the movement as a whole lacks space, then for women, we get even less access to space. So for this reason, we created the Hip-Hop Symposium, where we have a workshop on gender to orient and reorient how a woman's role is understood, building consciousness about women's role in hip-hop.
You're listening to Into the Music on ABCRN. I'm Vipa Fernandez, and this is my sister's hip-hop odyssey. Now, in Australia, young people were part of a hip-hop scene. Sujatha was struck by how everyone in Cuba referred to it as a movement. It did align more with what my sister believed theoretically to be true, with rap being a voice of dissent. So it made sense then that all the dissenters would together form a movement. But hang on, wasn't dissent in Cuba banned? Pablo helped my sister, still a newbie in Havana, understand what dissent meant in the Cuban context.
Within Cuba, I think hip-hop, rather than just being a voice of dissent, I think the first thing it did when people realized that they could rap was basically allowing them to understand that they could have a voice for themselves, and that it was as powerful as soon as you can actually think about it, you wrote it, made it a rhyme, made it into a hip-hop form that you liked and your friends liked. You grabbed the microphone, you said it, and it was out there, and lots of people could listen to it. In the beginning, Cuban hip-hop, when it became conscious of itself, the first thing that he talked about was things like understanding religion and being part of society, and say like Aminaza's song Acha Bon Cursa, which is such a big theme because it actually touched the racial theme in Cuba. That became an icon of what people could talk about.
Sobreviviendo, ahora sé por qué tú me diste flores. Gracias, favores a los rencores, machacado en tus temores. No es pa' que llores, que mucha gente ya lo han hecho por todos nosotros. Ahora nosotros nos toca crecer para nacer otro. Pero de diablo son las.
This song talks about the struggle with being mixed race in Cuba. Too light-skinned to be seen as black, but not white either. Pablo was instrumental in the success of this popular rap group Amenaza, whose name literally translates to threat. Pablo also worked with Magia and Alexei on their music.
Yo te enseño. Yo te enseño.
El viento mueve mi melena cuando por las calles voy. Y en esas calles siempre me agreden porque no saben quién soy.
Me lo suelto carretera, no hay derris. Me di cuenta que pa' qué si yo no nací así. El hombre que me quiere me acepta como soy.
¡Africana!
A donde quiera que voy. Mi naturaleza rompe patrón de belleza. No me vengan con que pa' lucir más fina.
Hay que plancharse la cabeza pa' verse más femenina.
Oye, menona, nanina, mis códigos se terminan.
Claro. Y en ese por encima de todo.
It's just about, you know, cigars, women, beautiful beaches.
Pero Cuba es mucho más que eso y nosotros somos una muestra de eso. Entonces,
vamos. Cuba is a lot more and we're about to show you that. Matter of fact, we're proof of that.
Sí, ahora dime esto. Sí, hip-hop para siempre. Esto es lo que se hace ahí en la banda.
Magia and Alexei's group Obsesión was respected by all sectors of Cuba's hip-hop movement. At a concert in Alamar, Sujatha met a young rapper, Julio Cardenas, a.k.a. El Hip Hop Kid. He was a tall guy with a short afro and an earnest expression. Julio was raised by his mother in the neighbouring sector of Guanabacoa. As a kid, he'd come rushing home from school to watch the b-boys battling or laying out cardboard strips on the back patio of his building. He watched Beat Street, Fast Forward and Breakin' and copied all the moves.
Después nos invitaron por primera vez a un festival que se hizo, un pequeño festival en un liceo en Regla, en el municipio de Regla, donde viven la gente de Obsesión.
So our first invitation to perform in a small festival was in the municipality of Regla, where the Cuban rappers Obsession live. It was like a peña that they held every Tuesday night. It was pretty impressive. We showed up there and there were like 20 other groups invited that night. And of all those groups, they picked one group to perform at the big event on Saturday night, and they chose us. But you have to understand that this is an audience that has no understanding of hip-hop. The night we performed, the audience was all young people because it was the summer holidays. And they were excited to see rappers, but they had no idea about rap.
Oh, wow, los raperos, ah, sí, que se oyen, man. Pero todavía la gente no tenía idea, ¿no? De lo que estaba pasando, no había una seriedad.
But here's the thing. There were groups that the audience loved, groups that made people reflect, and groups that they didn't like at all. They were throwing beer cans at some groups they didn't like, shouting things like, these people are worthless, because they were from the countryside, and you know how country folks are. And I have no idea why, but thank God, we were chosen as the winners that night. And you have to understand, this audience was full of drunks and boys running after women, all white people. Nothing to do with our world. And when the salsa group took a break and they quickly stuck us on, I thought, man, these people have nothing to do with what we're about to perform. But with all of that, they still voted us the best, which is really what made me believe so much in what we call the hip-hop movement, believe in my group, and believe in myself.
One of the things that most of me made me believe in the movement and believe in my group and believe in me.
Julio moved to the low-income suburb of Alamar at the age of 15 and got caught up in the hip-hop movement that was taking Alamar by storm. He'd go to moños, or block parties, where people rapped and DJed. After Julio finished school, he went on to technical college to do a degree in civil construction. But he graduated at the height of the special period, when there was no jobs, so he went to work with his grandfather in the nearby fisheries for some cash to help out his mother and get the local authorities off his back. Eventually, he found a job as a bridge operator, raising and lowering the bridge that connected Alamar and Cojimar to allow the ships to pass through. The job was a no-brainer. At 7 a.m., Julio would raise the bridge. By early afternoon, when all the boats had gone through, he would sit back with his friends exchanging news about who had the latest rap magazine from the U.S. In 1996, Julio formed the group Raperos Crazy de Alamar, or RCA, with two friends.
Pablo Herrera, yo fui a su casa. Y entonces me está poniendo uno de sus últimos CD, porque Pablo Herrera es el que más vínculo y relación tenía en Cuba con todos los americanos y los gringos aquí.
Pablo Herrera. It was Pablo Herrera who gave me the mixtapes because Pablo was the guy in Cuba who was most connected to American music. And so I heard this and thought that I could do my own music. And this was one of the things that inspired me most. And so at first it was just an idea, but bit by bit we got more serious. And finally our first song was a big hit. For me, now, that song sounds pretty old. Well, I mean old school, like the stuff Pablo was doing. But what the people really liked was the group influence, the influence of the voices, the way it all came together and mostly our energy. People loved it. We'd go around the hood and kids would be singing our song and they'd see us and say, it's the group RCA, RCA.
A golpe de palmada vengo pa' que te sofoque. Quiero que goces con las manos arriba el toque de este ritmo que nos une. Quiero que sube pa' que vea que voltaje sube y que lo que consume va en la sangre.
By 1999, Julio and his group were the stars of a Cuban rap festival that also featured famous African-American artists like Mos Def, Talib Kweli, DJ Hi-Tech, Dead Prez, Common. Everyone in Cuba was excited about the festival. And when Dead Prez got up and rapped, I'm African, I'm African, in front of the crowd of thousands at the festival, the amphitheater resounded with thundering response from the Cuban audience, chanting back the words. It was Pan-Africanism in motion. But the politics didn't always translate. This is Julio's version of that festival.
Entonces mira cuál es el problema. Cuando ya el movimiento de hip-hop se fue, ya como se dice, formalizando, se fue.
So as the hip-hop movement became formalized and professional, there was a night I'll never forget. It was in 1998 at a rap festival, and it was a hilarious night. It was a festival where Mos Def and Dead Prez were performing. And I remember it because the first night, it was a Wednesday, the pre-festival, and there was no electricity. So there was no audio. It was in Alamar. And then suddenly, One kid who lived right in front of the amphitheater. His father had some gear, and he brought us one mic with a little amp, and everyone sang with that one mic. And I was smoking and drinking, you know, that really bad wine they sell in Cuba. I drank half a bottle, and I said, wow, yeah, wah, wah, wah. Wah, wah, wah. And we shouted, long live the paste hoja. Do you know what the paste hoja is? It's that famous product that Fidel gave out in the rations. Because at that point, when we didn't have anything, he gave us this. It was like a fried dumpling. And we were saying, long live rap. And us rappers, and long live the paste hoja. And the crowd went, ah! Anyways, and then the next day the festival started, and Mos Def and Dead Prez arrived. But one of the funniest things about this night was that as Mos Def and Talib Kweli were performing, people left. They were saying, Reyes de la Calle are better than these guys, or Joe Smith is better than these guys, because they didn't understand anything they were saying. And then you know what hard times Cuba was facing then. And on stage, Dead Prez takes a dollar bill, shows it to the crowd, and sets it on fire. He says in English, because of this dollar bill, kids in my country are dying due to crack or drugs or bling bling. And people started screaming at him, no, give me the dollar, I'll buy some fried chicken. And the crowd is screaming, wah! And then Raquel Riviera, who is translating, tells the crowd what he is saying. In my country, kids are dying because of this dollar. And people are saying, no, here, here, people are dying too.
Sujatha's been back to Havana many times over the past decade, including the time when Pablo mixed beats for her to use over her rap lyrics, and the days when she was mistakenly called on stage to perform at a small afternoon rap show and no one understood anything she was saying. Her later trips as a professor and researcher, either taking groups of students or conducting interviews with rappers, allowed her to observe the progress of the hip-hop movement. One of the interesting developments was the Cuban state formation of an agency just to support rappers, even though sometimes these rappers were themselves critical of the state. As the Cuban government began to support the hip-hop movement, rappers knew that along with the paycheck for being a rapper came a degree of state censorship. This was in stark contrast to America, where there was no government support for hip-hop culture. Many American rappers had to work minimum wage jobs to support their independent music production because record deals were hard to come by. Comparing Cuba to the US brought a moment of revelation for my sister. So here I am in Cuba, hanging out with rappers, performing a little bit myself here and there, and really just watching the Cubans figure out their own way of making music. A real do-it-yourself kind of thing. Which made me think that maybe the DIY model really was the key to a dynamic hip-hop planet. This was a model that had already flourished in various American cities, including Chicago, where I had gone after Havana to do a PhD at the University of Chicago.
Come take a ride with us.
Freedom, how can
yeah.
Such a thing be
fair?
You please come to Chicago.
This is Mike Trees from Mass Hysteria, live from the south side of Chicago. Hip hop aficionado, tough act to follow, and all of that. What's good?
Sujatha was supposed to be studying, but she was constantly drawn to the underground clubs where hip hop heads gathered. She first met Mike Trees in a pizza parlor in Chicago's Hyde Park. He was this shy white guy wearing a baseball cap pulled down low. And back then, this famous rapper on the underground scene had a day job delivering pizzas.
Well, I first got into hip-hop in the late 80s. The mid-80s, really, like 85, 86. I was breakdancing in grammar school and got exposed to the music through my older brother and just stayed with it over the years. Eventually started rapping in the early 90s, started DJing in the early 90s. And then just kept going and kept getting better.
Check it out, one time for your mind, mass hysteria, blowing up the spot. Check it, we're gonna do it like this on a regular. Check it out, yo.
Mike Treese helped organize these large gatherings of young hip-hop artists in the early 90s. And it seems kind of cliche, but they actually did meet on abandoned train tracks around the city. And from here, many of Chicago's underground artists got their start.
Everybody in my high school in 92, we used to throw hip-hop meetings to show you how deep it was. And we'd be like, you can only come to the meeting if you did one of the elements. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you did one of the four elements, you couldn't just come if you was a fan. Because like we was like, we've been fans our whole life. Now it's like, okay, we 18 now. Now we're going to do something serious. So are you a rapper? You a DJ? Are you a graffiti writer? You a B-boy? What the fuck do you do? You know what I'm saying? You a producer? So you had to do something. And it would be like, you know, it's like 100 motherfuckers of us. We used to meet up on the train tracks and we called it the heat box. And the metro tracks. It's like a glass enclosed place where you wait for the train. And we just meet up there. We'd be rapping. Graffiti kids would be doing graffiti. Then people would start breaking. And it'd just be like, you know, for us, that was our beat street.
My name is Turhan. I'm the special guest on Mass Hysteria's Jam. We about to get ricky for y'all. We got Mookie, the super producer. We got Tech Nine, the lyrical assault weapon. G-Field Rock, the modern day poet. I'm Turhan, and first up the bat is Mike Tree's first impression. Kick! I kick ass quick fast. So
the way hip-hop artists have made it big in the US has been through radio play and record deals. As the 90s wore on, it became a kind of chicken and egg game. You couldn't get a record deal if you weren't getting airplay, but the only artists getting airplay already had record deals. So if you ask the underground rappers, they blame Clear Channel. Clear who, you ask? Well, in the US, Clear Channel's this company that's stealthily taken over many radio stations and music venues. It's happened in the last 2 decades, as the government has relaxed media ownership regulations. What this meant for unsigned artists as radio playlists became formulaic was that they only played the big-name rappers. So many artists took the do-it-yourself route and produced their own music and mixtapes and pushed them out. Which is exactly what MC Ange 13 has done for years now.
I'll take you back in time, the year is 89. Concrete and my behind in the twine, locked with the doors to the shrine. And among this, it was moms who brung this. Sit back, I'm gonna tell you how my peeps and I swung it. My childhood wasn't good, in fact, if I was a Negro, still my whole world would be black. Survive inside my mother's womb, so yes, my life
was different. Back in the day, because there weren't a lot of female MCs out there. People expected me to either be dope or whack. And I didn't want to be whack. So I had to do everything that I could to prove that I was dope. That meant staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning pushing flyers. That means staying out in front of clubs for hours freestyling with guys. And, you know, I could be out there just losing battle after battle, but I was out there.
That's Angela Zone, a.k.a. Ange 13. Suji was mesmerized by her powerful lyrical skills.
The date was 8:28:00 at 6:05. A nurse called, your mommy needs you bedside. Can you make it here in time? I was south, she was way up north in ER. I hopped the subway cause I got no car. Call my bigger sis, man, I ain't believing this. They mommy's gonna die, I ain't got a tear in either eye. It's a long ride to EV with St. Francis at. They found the act, macho beast laying flat on the back. Incoherent with the appearance, more calm in the heights.
Ange 13 reminded me of Wayata in a way. The hard realities of her life was what she rapped about and hoped to change through the music. My own path in Chicago took a somewhat of a different turn as I found my own little performance niche.
I can see you in the night, sense the sadness in your flight. Feel you tremble as you stagger on defeated. 6 months ago, a glow was a promise of love and a power.
I sang with another Indian woman, and our music was more identity focused and more bluntly feminist.
You're my shadow, you're my power. Let me speak to you, my girl. Rise, rise, and keep on rising. Rise, rise, and keep
our family found it incredible that everywhere Suji went, she managed to find a place to perform. Would Suji be the next big rap star now that she was in America? For a while, I enjoyed doing my music again and finding a place where it was accepted, but I didn't really relate to this scene. For a start, I wasn't Asian American. I'd never really thought of myself as any kind of ethnic or hyphenated identity like Desi or Asian or Indian. And when I performed the songs I'd written in Australia that referred to local political events, people and places, no one knew what I was talking about. At least when I performed in Cuba, no one understood what I was saying anyway.
The other problem was that the Asian American hip-hop scene was completely divorced from the underground, where reputations were built through hard work and mastery of lyrical wordplay. I quickly realized that I was more interested in exploring the underground rap scene, a place where few rappers were able to score a record deal, or no matter how good they were, or how much popular support they had at the clubs. She feel that you with me, well move hit me with some shit that'll
fit me, cause I got lyrics, now who wanna hear some? Suji's friend, Mike Treese, was gaining popularity as a rapper, but he still remained part of the underground scene.
The complicated part of it is we all loved hip-hop so much, but we didn't know how to make it a career. Hip-hop was something that people in New York did as a career, and people in LA did as a career, and it was pretty much limited to those cities back then. Then Chicago, the only two people that had record deals were Common Sense and Twista. And we were underground because we had no choice. I had a line about that, where I'm from the town where you got no choice but to be underground. You know, but not 6 feet. We all up in this deep. So, like, but when we were all doing it because we loved doing it. And you would try to get shows here and there, and you would try to make songs here and there, and put out your own CDs here and there. But it didn't really feel like a career. You know, none of the 90s felt like a career.
What that basically meant was that Mike Treese, Ange 13, and many others had to sell their own stuff.
Yo, what's up? You like Chicago hip-hop? You got love for Juice, for All Natural, for Mass Hysteria, for Common? Check the CD out right here. I got new songs from all of them. It's dope. Holla. So I made a product that was all Chicago hip-hop, and I'd already get their attention by grabbing them in with the fresh artwork. They'd look at it, see it was official, and it would be that simple. And not saying everybody would buy it, but the people that were interested, that's all it would take. I get a rush when I bust some dope lines over. 1, 2, 1, 2, it's like that now. I get a rush when I bust some dope lines over. That may be somebody who as I take the stage and my fresh dip gear.
So did Sujatha find what she began searching for all those years ago in suburban Maroubra?
You know, Deepa, in the end, my journey was to discover what hip-hop means to young people in different countries. What united us all, from us kids back in Sydney, to Mahi and Julio in Cuba, and Mike Treese and Ange 13 in Chicago, was that we've all used hip-hop to search out our place.
I still call Australia home.
For me, my quest has been to find the place I belong. It's been a search for home.
They don't really want to see every page in the book of our history. They gotta change their policy to understand us, cause they really don't. What about that we own this land? Maybe we got.
When I was growing up, I never felt that Australia was my home. I never felt that I belonged there, or anywhere for that matter. Back then, I turned to hip-hop to try and understand my place in the world, and today I still do. This song, I Still Call Australia Home, by the Aboriginal group The Last Connection, speaks to me in a way that few songs do. We still call Australia, still call
Australia. I said no, we didn't walk around land, and no, we don't get money in the hand, and no, went on a bunch of lazy drunks, and no, this is our land, you got a problem
with us?
Come sort it out. Sitting back, talking crap with your workmates. You don't know where we're from, where we've been, what we've been through. The only thing you see is 2D through the media. If you don't know, then find out. We're up a river vision, decision that you're missing. It's a crap history, but it's still our story. Ain't this place good home, the place where we belong.
We still call Australia, still call Australia.
I think that my travels showed me that there is no perfect place, but that through community we can build a home. And while I haven't been an MC for the last decade, I've been writing about hip-hop and exploring the art form globally. Me and Cornel West at Princeton trying to convince those ivory elites that hip-hop is a worthy academic pursuit. But almost 2 decades after I first wrote a rap, and 3 books later, I do believe I've found something. The hip-hop movement has built a community, one that we can all belong to wherever we live.
Let me elbows go loose, Lou. Let me elbows go loose. There are no further use, Lou. So let me elbows go loose. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. We still